Do you want to save any time for rebuttal, counsel?
I would like to reserve 2 minutes, if I may.
Yes, sir. You may begin when ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is David Hargett, and I represent Frizzell on the appeal of his convictions out of Pennsylvania County. There are 5 assignments of error, and for the belief that I might not be able to get through all of them, I would like to start with the jury instructions and circle back, if I may.
Well, let me ask you 2 questions that one of which the Commonwealth addressed, but you didn't in your brief, and the other neither of you addressed. Let's see if I can find my notes here. The first question I have is that in terms of the Fourth Amendment, I realize you weren't trial counsel and didn't file the motion to suppress, but I question whether there was any sort of seizure here at all until after, you know, the shooting began, because, I mean, under our Bolhard jurisprudence, that of the U.S. Supreme Court, you're not seized until you actually submit to authority. And in addition to that, we have evidence in the record in the light most favorable of the Commonwealth that your client was not the driver. He was a passenger. And the driver at some point said that, she, you know, when the officer, you know, was behind her, she pulled over on her own even before he lit her up with the lights and siren. And I realized that as a passenger, you know, under the Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, his standing to take a Fourth Amendment position is derivative from that of the driver. So, you know, for those 2 reasons, I first of all question whether there's even a Fourth Amendment seizure here until after he's arrested, essentially, you know, shooting at the deputy. And then the second question, which was dealt with by the Commonwealth, but I noticed you didn't respond in your brief to it at all, is our holding in Brown versus the City of Danville, where we held that even assuming a Fourth Amendment violation, the exclusionary rule does not operate to suppress additional criminal conduct. I mean, you suppress evidence by way of, you know, objects that are seized or whatever, but you don't suppress, or at least we held in that case, that because the exclusionary rule is a prophylactic remedy, it's very extreme and it's only used in extreme circumstances, that it basically it isn't used or can't be used to suppress and allow someone to get away with additional and unrelated criminal conduct. So could you address both of those points that you did not address on your
assuming
brief?
You can even remember them at this point.
Yes, I'll take them in order. So as far as his not complying with the officer's request or demands that he stop, the motion to suppress in this case was limited to the stop itself. So I have focused on the fact that he was stopped as a passenger in the vehicle, assuming, and of course there's another component, but assuming that the vehicle was pulled over by the officer, then he was effectively stopped at that point.
But if factually the driver did not stop at the command of the officer but stopped on her own, does that change the dynamic?
Well, that's the second part of that question. So the first is that he was stopped when the officer pulled him over. The second is that she did say that she was hitting her brake lights, et cetera, and that she was pulling over when she saw the officer coming, and then the officer activated his lights. I would say at that point that whether she changed her mind or not doesn't matter, because she's not free to pull off without eluding, and therefore, because she then stopped, she was actually stopped by the officer when he activated his emergency equipment and, by extension, stopped the passenger. So that's number. That's 2 parts of the first question. The second question having to do with committing additional crimes after the stop occurred, I do commend the AG for bringing up an issue which had not been addressed by the prosecution at trial, nor the trial court, nor the prosecution in the brief in opposition, and nor the per curiam opinion of this court. So this has been the first time that it's been brought up. But I understand that an unlawful stop does not give you license to kill or license to commit any other additional offense if you wish. So the point is, I think that their best argument here, without taking up too much of my time on this issue, is that the fact that the court denied the motion to suppress means that there was nothing else that was done. We don't know what additional arguments or evidence would have been suppressed, because the court never found that he needed to suppress any evidence. And I would say that why it would be important is because this is one of those situations where If it was an unlawful stop, then that's certainly information that could have been given to the jury. Now, I know that trial counsel didn't proffer a jury instruction that says that the stop was unlawful and therefore he doesn't have to comply with any commands because it's an unlawful stop, but that is certainly a part of this case, and that could have been something that happened if the court had agreed to suppress the stop itself. And so the question then becomes, at which point do we suppress? Do we suppress it all the way up to the point where Mr. Frizzell allegedly fired his firearm? And if that's the case, then there is a chunk.
Well, when was he seized? I mean, he didn't submit to any authority.
I would say he was stopped when the car was stopped. And I have to focus on that because that's the argument that was made.
He stopped moving, obviously, from point A to point B when the car was stopped. But the officer didn't lay his hands on him. He clearly didn't submit to the officer's authority because he advanced on the officer and then eventually pulled the gun and started shooting at him. So under the Hodari D case and others, if there's no seizure, if you're not submitting, the Fourth Amendment hasn't been triggered yet, has it?
Well, I think that he does voluntarily give up his rights to transport, to movement, by being a passenger in the car. But he does not voluntarily submit to the stop of that vehicle. And I think that the stop is where I would focus.
But even if it's an unlawful stop, you can't resist to the extent that your client resisted.
You can resist, but you cannot engage in additional criminal activity. I would agree with that. So moving on to the voluntary intoxication instruction, which I think is the crux of this case. I understand that what was given at trial is a model instruction, but that model instruction is incorrect. It is incorrect, and it's been phrased as burden shifting, and that's a little bit, maybe a bit of an overstatement, but what it essentially says is that the evidence doesn't have to prove that he was voluntarily intoxicated. All the evidence needs to do from the defense standpoint is present enough of evidence that he was voluntarily intoxicated to raise a reasonable doubt. And if there's a reasonable doubt that he was voluntarily intoxicated, then
is the instruction that was proffered by trial counsel legally correct? Because I'm going to read it. If at the time of the attempted homicide, appellant's state of mind was caused by voluntary intoxication, looks like we're good until that point, or other factors, or it was such that a reasonable doubt exists, blah, 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 it seems to me that your argument would be stronger, shall we say, if we didn't have that clause or other factors, which is pretty nebulous. And so essentially, if the trial judge had chosen not to give that instruction, it could be justified as that it was an incorrect statement of the law.
And that would normally be the case, but I would say that there is case law, plenty of case law from this court and the Supreme Court that states that it is an affirmative duty of the court to correct an instruction if it's a vital instruction to the defense.
And the trial judge would say, I corrected the instruction by giving Commonwealth's instruction 21.
Well, but the difference between the two, if you strike the language or other factors, and counsel tried to argue what those other factors were during the argument, not outside the presence of the jury about that. So, I agree that without it being defined, it makes it really difficult. But the court did understand that there is a difference between the two, the defense did argue there's a difference between the two instructions without the other factors language, and that is that it not be proven that he was voluntarily intoxicated, but it be enough to raise a reasonable doubt.
So would it be your position that instruction 21 is a misstatement of the law?
I think that the instruction 21 is an incorrect statement of the law. It would be better stated that it is not an affirmative defense. In other words, the defense doesn't have to prove that it was voluntarily intoxicated. All that's necessary is to present enough evidence or there be enough evidence that there's a reasonable doubt.
See, I might argue with you about that because I think the law is pretty clear, and I don't know that I classify voluntary intoxication as necessarily an affirmative defense as such. It certainly isn't of the character of self-defense or insanity in terms of being an affirmative defense, but the law is clear that you are presumed to be capable of forming intent, and the burden of persuasion, not the burden of proof, but the burden of persuasion is clearly, it seems to be based on the case law, on the defense to establish or to rebut that presumption, just like people are presumed to be sane. You raise an insanity defense, you have the burden of persuasion of convincing the fact finder that the presumption that you are sane has been rebutted at least to the point of raising a reasonable doubt. So this instruction says, if you find the instruction that was given, the model instruction says, if you find the defendant was so greatly intoxicated by the voluntary use of alcohol that he was incapable of deliberating or premeditating, then you cannot find him guilty of any offense greater than attempted second-degree murder. And I'm struggling to understand what's incorrect about that instruction, because it clearly takes into account the presumption that in the absence of voluntary intoxication, you know, the Commonwealth has no burden to prove that your state of mind, you know, is under the control of reason. The burden of persuasion to the opposite is on the defense.
The Commonwealth still has the burden to prove that it was
prove the elements. They have to prove the elements of the crime beyond
right.
reason.
And I don't know that a jury could ever make those subtle distinctions. But the intoxication argument, just so we understand, in the model instruction talks about alcohol, and the proffered instruction is just intoxication. And there was plenty of evidence presented that not only was he had he consumed a tremendous amount of alcohol, he had also consumed or had partaken in marijuana, and that was testimony as to the effects on his ability to be deliberate in his actions and know what he was doing as far as the first-degree murder, the premeditated aspect is concerned. So there are differences there, but I would still say the difference between a burden of persuasion versus a burden of proof is not really something that a jury would understand. I mean, ideally...
But we're not a jury. We're, you know, and we have to wrestle with these legal fine points.
Right, but I think it's a correct statement to say that the defense does not have to prove that he was voluntarily intoxicated in order for the jury to latch onto that instruction and find him guilty of nothing worse than second-degree murder. The defense does not have the burden to prove that. And if that is true, then it is also true that the statement that the jury, the model jury instruction, leaves out a part that could be extremely important. So there's a world where no instruction at all is going to convince the jury. There's a world where if the evidence proves that he was so intoxicated he could not inform that level of intent. And that's with the jury instruction. But there's a world that's right in the middle, and that is where there's enough evidence to show, or information or what have you, to show that he could not have formed it, at least to raise a reasonable doubt whether he could have formed the intent or not. And if there's a reasonable doubt about that, then the jury instruction needs to address that.
Let me ask you this, just generically. If there are two instructions, one proffered by the Commonwealth and one proffered by the defense, and they deal with the same element of the crime, and the court chooses the Commonwealth but fails to choose the defense because the court determines that the Commonwealth is better for some reason. Is there a problem? In other words, is the defense entitled to its choice of instructions?
I would say yes.
Yes, what?
The defense is entitled to their choice of instructions. The defense is entitled to
the law doesn't support that, though.
It does say that the court is required to instruct the jury on the defense theory of the case. And so if all things otherwise being equal, if there's a difference between the jury instructions, then the defense instruction should be given if it's a correct statement of law.
What was the specific objection? I'm struggling to find it in the record. I can't lay my hands on it. But can you tell me what the specific objection was to the model instruction, if there was one? Or was it just we want this instruction instead kind of thing?
The defense argued that it was a burden shifting, and that's what I'm talking about. That's where it raises a reasonable doubt. That's the question, and that should have been part of the instruction, which is what was proffered. And the second part of it was the other factors, and okay. We've already addressed that.
Okay, counsel, in your rebuttal time. Thank you. For the government.
Good morning. May it please the court, Donald Jeffrey on behalf of the Commonwealth. To get to a couple of points that Judge Humphreys made, we didn't talk about that, and admittedly Ms. Haley's testimony is at page 390 of the appendix, would seem to suggest that there's a question whether there was actually a stop at all. Yeah, that said, we did address on brief the Hodari D issue, which was actually one of the rulings of the trial court, which has not been appealed, which I think could be dispositive in this case, is that he was never seized because he didn't submit until after the relevant.
Well, I raise it only because, and just to explain you know, where I'm coming from. I noticed that the one judge denial order in this case did note the fact that she pulled over voluntarily, and that suggested to me at least that maybe, you know, it's just, as you pointed out in your brief, we have to decide these cases on the narrowest and best grounds insofar and avoid the constitutional issue if we possibly can.
Right.
If that's the case, and if, you know, but I noticed you didn't argue it on your brief, that's why I asked about it, and Mr. Hargett didn't address it in his brief, it was just raised in the one judge, and I thought, well, that's interesting. If that's actually the case where she pulled over voluntarily, then and of course his standing to attack any Fourth Amendment issue is derivative of hers. If there's no Fourth Amendment issue with respect to her, then clearly there's none with respect to him as a passenger in the vehicle. So, you know, that to me would be the narrowest and best grounds to resolve it, but the next best would be the one you raised, which would be the exclusionary rule wouldn't apply in any event, it seems to me.
Well, it is derivative, and usually in situations like that, I have a footnote in my brief explaining why we didn't address that. I know it was discussed below. I don't recall whether the trial judge, any part of his ruling was contingent on that issue of whether there was a stop or not. And that may be why I didn't touch that. I also think there may have been some conflicting testimony. I can certainly go back in and try to unpack that for you if you'd like. It may have been why we didn't make that argument initially. I really don't recall. It was an issue raised in the case below. That's for certain.
I was just curious. I mean, I'm not necessarily suggesting that. I mean, you know the record better than I do, and I was frankly trying to get a handle on that, and I'm not sure I could do any better than you could there.
Well, I think there may have been some testimony that was a little closer on that point. That I just pulled it up while you were talking a minute ago, and page 390, Ms. Haley's testimony is very consistent with what you suggested. And I know that was an issue the Commonwealth raised below. Perhaps when I wrote this brief, the holding by the trial court was in part based on the Hodari D issue, and I don't see any assignment of error or argument with respect to that. So I may have just looked at that and decided that was the narrow.
My progression in these Fourth Amendment cases has always been, you know, to ask the question that a lot of people skip over, which is, does the Fourth Amendment even apply in the first place before you get to, you know, what the remedy is and all that stuff. So.
Right, and I do think clearly there was the Hodari D. Brendlin is the passenger case, and that they actually talk about Hodari D and its implications in that context in Brendlin. And so you have that issue here. You certainly also have the Brown and the Testa issue with respect to the subsequent criminal conduct attenuating any taint. And I think either one of them is sufficient to affirm the judgment below. If you'd like further briefing on the issue about whether there was a stop or not, I'll be glad to provide it.
I think you might want to address the jury instruction issue, too.
Yeah, it was raised, I believe, as a burden-shifting issue below. I've pulled Sandstrom, I've pulled cases that talk about...
Let me ask you this. What's your response to Mr. Hargett's position that the model instruction that was given incorrectly states the law in terms of the burden the defense has in establishing voluntary intoxication as a part of the defense?
First of all, and I cited some of these on brief, there's nothing in that instruction about a burden, as you would see with insanity and other types of affirmative defenses. I looked in vain for a case that, whether we have ever had a case use the label that it's an affirmative defense or not, which of course would potentially actually get you to the ability to get the Commonwealth the ability to have that burden of persuasion language that you have in an insanity instruction. And I couldn't find a case that said that. There is nothing in here that says he has any burden, first of all. And there's nothing of the conclusive presumption nature that was problematic under Sandstrom.
So is it safe to say that the Commonwealth's position is that Instruction 21 is a correct statement of the law, and the defendant wasn't entitled to their choice of instruction?
This court actually, Your Honor, this court actually said that in one of the cases I cited on brief. It may have been Vey, that even if the defense instruction is right, there's not reversible error if the one that was given was correct. So this court has previously contemplated that issue.
Right, and I think that's what we're asking. Do you think So is the Commonwealth's position that instruction 21 is correct?
Yes.
Is a correct statement of the law?
It is. And I know, I believe it was a model, and I know we get into issues about, you know, just because it's a model doesn't mean it's right. In this particular case, though, I don't see the burden shifting issue. You don't have express burden shifting language. And I certainly nothing in the nature of the Sandstrom conclusive, where you're required to draw an inference. In that case, the nature and consequences of the person's acts, that was the issue in Sandstrom. But you don't have anything like that here. What you have is you just have an instruction that talks about, I want to make sure I've got the text of it in front of me.
What, 21? If you find the defendant was so greatly intoxicated by the voluntary use of alcohol that he was incapable of deliberating or premeditating, then you cannot find him guilty of any offense greater than attempted second-degree murder.
None of that, thank you, I found it just as you started reading it to me, and none of that undercuts what I talked about on brief is you have several places where the jury was instructed about the presumption of innocence, the reasonable doubt standard, that the defendant has no burden to produce any evidence. So you've actually got that concept in front of the jury expressly about the burden. Through other instructions. That was instruction 1 at page 601 of the joint appendix. Instruction 11, that reiterates the reasonable doubt burden several times. That's at 611 and 612. And something else that I picked up on when I was looking at this.
Actually, one could argue that the proposed instruction by the defendant is a burden-shifting instruction because it talks about causation. The appellant's state of mind was caused by voluntary intoxication or other factors. So it's almost a burden-shifting circumstance there when you talk about causation and referencing the appellant's state of mind. So for what it's worth.
Okay. Certainly you had other instructions. They aren't undercut in terms of the burden. The jury was instructed that the defendant didn't have any burden to produce evidence. And so that was before it. And one that I didn't pick up on was on page 614 of the joint appendix, which is actually the doubt as to grade of offense, and that's a fairly standard instruction that's given. And essentially says if you have a doubt as to what the degree is, you have to resolve it in favor of the lower charge. And I point that out because the Supreme Court of Virginia in Warlittner, which wasn't cited on the 217 Virginia 348, actually that was one thing that they pointed to in an analysis with respect to a burden-shifting case was, in addition to other instructions, that instruction was also given. That wasn't something that we talked about on brief. So, in conclusion, I don't believe that there is any issue about burden shifting or any sort of impermissible conclusive presumption with respect to that instruction.
What about Mr. Hargett's point that if something is a defense, the defendant should be entitled to their choice of instructions? Is there law that supports that?
I think the way I understand the law, and I'm sorry, I couldn't put my finger on it when I was looking at the cases. It's one of the cases I cited on a brief actually talks about this. The way I understand the law, the first issue is it has to be vital to the defense. But this court, I believe, has also said that if you've got two that cover the subject, you're not entitled to that just because it's your instruction. And that really is the issue. You know, some of that may go towards harmless error as well, but I don't believe that's the way the court's analyzed it. I don't think if you've got one that's a valid, legitimate instruction, and of course I'm sensitive to what Judge Alston said a minute ago, you don't get yours just because it's yours. And if you'd like to cite for that, I'll be glad to follow up. It's in one of the cases that may be Vay. I just couldn't put my finger on it when I was preparing that argument this morning. The Dr. Russell issue, Mr. Hargett didn't talk about that. I'm content to rely on my brief on that, other than that I will add, I put a footnote in there that you didn't need to reach the issue of whether testimony about a conclusion that he wasn't capable of premeditating would be on the ultimate issue. I would suggest to you there is a string cite in this court's opinion, Patterson versus Commonwealth at 3 Virginia Appellate 1. 348 Southeast 2nd 285, a 1986 case, which includes a 1979 Supreme Court of Virginia case, which to me would suggest that type of testimony, because that's what was proffered, that when asked what would this person have put on, that he's being I'm foreclosing impermissibly. That was what was proffered, was about the premeditation. So I believe it would also have been an improper ultimate issue opinion. But again, the ruling based on needing to rely on Frizzell's statements to him was correct, legally correct, as we argued on brief. There were two other instructions in this case. I think those are adequately covered on brief, and I would certainly suggest, as I did on brief, that the imperfect self-defense wasn't really developed on brief as to what the theory was on that anyway.
Imperfect self-defense is, of course, a legal term of art, and I noticed that our Supreme Court abolished that as a defense in 1900 in Jackson versus Commonwealth to the extent that it undercuts the element of malice. Now, I think really in the context here, I suspect that it's really more in the nature of the right to resist as opposed to imperfect self-defense, which I think is just an unfortunate use of a legal term of art there. You just suggest that.
Correct, and the and as I noted on brief, I mean, certainly cited the facts as to why the self-defense instruction wouldn't have been proper. Among other things, the police officer has actually found the suppression here and used reasonable force in deploying his taser under these facts, and I don't think that decision was legally incorrect or plainly wrong, whatever standard you would ascribe to it. I don't think it fits within either box. So the right to resist just didn't exist there. And again, I don't think that it's really fully developed on brief. As I indicated here, the only argument that I believe was advanced below was that based on Haley's testimony, that the officer was mistaken in thinking that he needed to assist her, and there was certainly other testimony in the record, first of all, and second of all, the finding below, as I pointed out in brief on page 161, the testimony was that the officer believed that both he and Haley were in danger, and none of that was developed below or on brief. So for those reasons, I think when the trial court ultimately made its finding, it also went along those same lines. So for all of those reasons, I would ask the court to affirm the judgment below.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Got about a minute and 15 seconds, sir.
Thank you. When you call it a defense, the jury has no way of knowing that the defense doesn't have the burden to prove that defense. That's the whole point. And because the defense doesn't have to prove it, the jury should have been instructed more accurately as to whose burden that was.
Now, is this your point, or do you have a case to... to suggest, I mean, no, is this your argument to us, or do you have a case to support that?
Certainly there are cases that say that if it is not an affirmative defense, the defense doesn't have to prove it. So this instruction would actually help the jury understand that, regardless of what the generic instructions say. As far as the expanded definition of willful, I would say that it does require, premeditation does require that somebody actually reflect or consider before acting, and that was helpful. As far as the imperfect self-defense is concerned, the danger is that Mr. Frizzell was shocked with 50,000 volts or whatever it is, not once, but twice, and that was where he was in fear of his life.
All right, counsel. Thank you. The case is submitted, as is our custom. We'll come down and greet counsel.
Thank you.